You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 209 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Language of the Cosmos, 11 Lectures, translated by Agnes Schneeberg-Destour. This is the ninth lecture of the 11 lectures, given in Dornach on December 25th, 1921. Anyone who looks at the historical development of humanity only in terms of cause and effect, as is customary today, will not be able to gain from history itself what it could actually reveal in its own way to the individual human being, through its forces and impulses, if one tried to penetrate into the true essence of this historical process of becoming. The process of historical development can really only reveal itself to someone who is able to perceive a wisdom-filled activity in the historical sequence of events. We have almost reached the point today where people are of the opinion that anyone who sees a wisdom-filled event, either in the broader world context in general, or in the historical development of humanity in particular, must have surrendered to superstitious ideas and have introduced something self-fabricated into the events. And it is true, of course, that one should not project onto historical events whatever one may have thought up. We should not forcefully alter things to fit our own way of thinking, but instead try to let them speak to us through what they really are. And in the case of the historical process of becoming, provided we are sufficiently unbiased, we will be able to perceive something like an active wisdom everywhere, and especially at important turning points in human evolution. One of the things that has come about as a result of historical development is, above all, the timing of the individual festival days of the year, especially the days related to the important festivals. We cannot fail to notice, once we become aware that Christmas is a so-called immovable festival, that each year it falls near the winter solstice on December 24 and 25. In contrast, we have the Easter festival, which is a so-called movable festival, with its dates being determined according to the constellation of the sun and the moon, meaning that these dates are, in quotes, brought down from the extra-earthly universe, as it were. And it is certainly the case that if we take these festival days of the year in earnest, they have meaning for our life. They have a decisive impact on our life. And this is what they are meant to have. Meaningful, intense thoughts should arise in us on such festival days. Deeply felt perceptions and feelings should spring up from our heart and soul. Human beings should precisely, because of what they can experience inwardly during such festival times, feel connected to the passage of time and to what is actively at work in the passage of time. Now, for certain historical reasons, this way of determining the festival times has been fixed, and we should give some thought to this fact that Christmas is an immovable festival, whereas Easter is a movable festival, that Christmas occurs at a time when the earth is most closed off, as it were, from the influences of the extra-earthly universe, when the sun has the least effect upon the earth, when the earth uses its own forces, which it has retained from the time of summer and autumn, to call up its special garment for the shortest days. That is to say, when the earth becomes what it can inherently be through its own forces, with the least influence from the cosmos. That is when we celebrate Christmas. When the time then arrives again during which the earth experiences the most significant influences from the extra-earthly cosmos, when the warmth of the sun, the light of the sun, calls forth the vegetation from the soil, that is, when heaven is working together with the earth to weave the garment of the earth, as it were, that is when we celebrate Easter. And because this way of determining the festival dates has arisen from human thoughts, that were not arbitrarily and abstractly conceived by any one person, but rather from thoughts that have, as it were, permeated humanity throughout long epochs, thoughts that have evolved innately. Because of this, something has flowed into the development of history, something which, if understood, will create at the same time the possibility of inwardly venerating it, the possibility of looking back into the times of our forefathers with reverence, with devotion, with love. And when our attention is drawn to something like this, we can even come to realize that if we can see this wisdom at work in the development of history, then we will also be able to see arising from this history those forces and impulses that can then enter the human soul in the right way and work within the human soul in the right way. Christmas, as we celebrate it today during the shortest days of the year, on December 24 and 25, has only been celebrated in the Christian Church since the year A.D. 354. People do not usually think very deeply about the fact that even in Christian Catholic Rome, in the year A.D. 353, the Christmas festival, the festival of the birth of Christ, was not celebrated on this day. It could be said that it is one of the most interesting things in the study of history to see how, out of an instinctive sense of the historical process, and out of deeper sources of wisdom, although perhaps working unconsciously for the most part, the date of this Christmas festival was instituted. Something similar and yet fundamentally different had been celebrated in earlier times, January 6th, which was the festival of the appearance of Christ. And this festival of the appearance of Christ signified the remembrance of the baptism by John in the Jordan. This festival of the baptism by John in the Jordan had been celebrated as the decisive festival of Christianity during the earliest centuries. And it is only from the above-mentioned point in time that the festival of the appearance of Christ, the festival of the commemoration of the baptism by John in the Jordan, migrated back through the 12 holy nights to December 25, and was replaced by the festival of the birthday of Christ Jesus. This has to do with deep, meaningful inner processes of the development of Christianity throughout history. What is indicated by the fact that during the first centuries of the Christian worldview, it was the remembrance of the baptism in the Jordan that was celebrated. What does this baptism by John in the Jordan mean? This baptism by John in the Jordan signifies that for extra-earthly cosmic reasons, the being of Christ descended from heavenly heights and united with the being of the man, Jesus of Nazareth. Accordingly, this baptism by John in the Jordan implies a fertilization of the earth out of cosmic expanses. This baptism by John in the Jordan means an interaction and collaboration between heaven and earth. And inasmuch as this was a celebration of the festival of the appearance of Christ, it was a festival of a supersensible birth, the festival of the birth of Christ in the 30-year-old human being, Jesus. In the first centuries of the development of Christianity, people turned their attention above all to the appearance of Christ on the earth. And next to this view of the appearance of the extra-earthly being of Christ in the earthly realm, less significance was assigned to the earthly birth of the human being, Jesus of Nazareth, who received Christ into his own bodily nature only in his 30th year. This is how it was pictured in the early Christian centuries. In these centuries, therefore, it was the descent of the extra-earthly Christ that was celebrated. And people had tried to understand what it was that had actually taken place in the course of earthly existence. If we allow ourselves to get a sense of the historical development up to the time of the mystery of Golgotha, then it appears that in primordial times, humanity had been endowed with a primal wisdom of a supersensible nature, a primal wisdom for which we should have the deepest reverence, if we are able to fully perceive its inward qualities and its real essence. In these initial wisdom treasures of humanity, which appear childlike only when seen from an outer point of view, an infinite number of things are revealed, not only about the earthly, but especially also about the extra-earthly aspects, and how this extra-earthly element works on the earth. And we see how, in the course of human evolution, this light of a primordial wisdom shone less and less within human souls, and how human beings gradually lost their connection with this primordial wisdom. And it was precisely at the time, when the mystery of Golgotha was approaching, that this primal wisdom had lost its shine and had faded from human minds and souls. All aspects of the historical development in Greek and especially in Roman culture show in a variety of ways that humanity's most advanced were aware that a new heavenly element had to make its mark on earthly life, so that earth and humanity would be able to continue their essential development. To an unbiased observer, the entire earthly evolution of humanity reveals a separation into two parts. The first part is the era during which people were awaiting the mystery of Golgotha, with a sense of waiting that lived not only in simple childlike human souls, but also in those imbued with the highest wisdom. The second part is the era following the mystery of Golgotha, the time in which we stand at present. With respect to this era, there is an expectation of an ongoing, far-reaching fulfillment of the supersensible world, for a renewed influence of the extra-earthly cosmic reality upon the earthly events occurring in world evolution. This is how the mystery of Golgotha stands in the middle point of earth evolution, and how it gives this evolution its real meaning. I have often tried to illustrate this pictorially for my listeners by saying that one could look at something like the important painting of the Last Supper made by Leonardo da Vinci in Milan, although it no longer exists in its former artistic perfection, and observe how the Redeemer is pictured among his 12 disciples, how John's relationship to Christ is contrasted with Judas's relationship to Christ, and how we have the whole picture in front of us in all its color nuances. These events are depicted in a most characteristic way in this painting, and seen from the perspective of the mystery of Golgotha, one could actually say that if any being were to come down to earth from a foreign celestial body, it would be amazed at what it encounters of external reality. For we must assume that such a being from another planet would be accustomed to completely different surroundings, and it would be amazed at all the things created by human beings on the earth. But if this being were then led in front of this painting, in which the mystery of Golgotha has been uniquely presented in a most characteristic way, then it would immediately and intuitively sense something of the meaning of earthly existence from this picture, simply through the way in which Christ Jesus has been placed among his 12 disciples, who in turn are the representatives of the whole human race. One can indeed, based on a variety of perspectives, sense that the mystery of Golgotha gives the earth evolution its actual meaning. But the reality of this fact can only be fully experienced if one endeavors to understand that through the baptism by John in the Jordan, a supersensible being Christ entered a human being. This is how the Gnostics understood it, albeit not in the sense of the worldview that we are trying to regain through anthroposophy today. They understood it in the sense of their worldview, which represented the last remnant of the ancient primordial wisdom of humanity. One could say that there was just enough left of the instinctive primal wisdom of humanity in the first Christian centuries after Christ had appeared to allow for the possibility that a number of people would still be able to understand what actually took place with the appearance of Christ on the earth. The kind of wisdom that the Gnostics had can no longer be ours, because humanity must be in a continual state of progress. We must advance toward a much more conscious, less instinctive understanding, also of the supersensible. Nevertheless, we can still look with reverence at the wisdom of the Gnostics, who had retained enough of the original, instinctive, primal wisdom of human beings, to be able to grasp the full meaning of the mystery of Golgotha. And it was this understanding of the meaning of the mystery of Golgotha, and of the essential, central occurrence, the baptism by John in the Jordan, that led to the resolve to celebrate this first great festival. But the development of the history of humanity had been structured in such a way that the old primordial wisdom had to fade away and dwindle. And it was precisely in the 4th century AD that people no longer knew how to interpret this primal wisdom. Yesterday I described from a different point of view how this primordial wisdom was gradually becoming obscure. In a certain sense, the 4th century denotes the first time that human beings were placed in the situation of having to rely completely on themselves, of having nothing around them for their forming of conceptions other than what the senses can perceive and what the rational intellect can make out of these sense perceptions. One could say that in order to attain freedom, humanity had to lose the old primordial wisdom, that humanity could never have attained freedom as long as it depended on extra-earthly things and as long as the primordial wisdom had not dwindled. That, therefore, in order to attain freedom, humanity had to lose the old primordial wisdom and be thrown out into the materialistic view of the world. This materialistic view emerged in its first beginnings during the 4th century AD and grew stronger and stronger until it reached its culmination point in the 19th century. But even materialism has its positive aspects in the history of human development. Because human beings no longer had a supersensible light shining into their minds and souls, because they had to rely on what they observed around them with their senses, an independent force, predisposed toward freedom, had been awakened in them. There is wisdom even in the fact that materialism made its appearance in the history of human evolution. But it was precisely at the time when materialism took possession of the earthly nature of human beings that it was no longer possible to understand that the influence of an extra-earthly, heavenly reality had been placed before humanity in the symbol of the baptism by John in the Jordan. That is, when people lost in a way the meaning of the festival of January 6, the festival of the appearance of Christ, and when they began to take refuge in other things. Everything that people experienced as impressions, as depths of feeling regarding the mystery of Golgotha, all this was now no longer experienced in relation to the extra-earthly Christ, but rather in relation to the earthly Jesus of Nazareth. And the festival of the appearance of Christ became the festival of the appearance of the child Jesus. At the present time, however, evolution has once again reached a pivotal point, a point where new essentialities are called for with respect to our human endeavors, in accordance with our current understanding of the world. We can see that as early as the 4th century, it was no longer possible for human beings to grasp the appearance of Christ with a wisdom-filled understanding. But in the course of history, human perception, human will, and human feeling develop at a slower pace than human thinking. When thoughts had long since ceased to focus on the appearance of Christ, hearts still turned to this appearance of Christ. Deep inner feelings lived in Christianity, and for many centuries these inner feelings formed the content of historical development. These deep inner feelings were an expression, albeit more like instinctive impulses, of the real meaning of what had taken place with the appearance of Christ, and of its significance for the evolution of the earth. The festival of the birth of Jesus of Nazareth had been linked with the Adam and Eve Day, the festival of humanity's beginning on earth. Adam and Eve Day is on December 24, the festival of Jesus' birthday on December 25. In Adam and Eve, people saw the human beings with whom earthly evolution began, the human beings who descended from spiritual heights, who sinned on earth, who became entangled in material things on earth, who lost their connection with the supersensible worlds. People spoke of the first Adam in the Pauline sense and of the second Adam, as of Christ himself, meaning that in the Christ era, we can only be complete human beings if we unite the powers that had fallen away from God through Adam with the powers that lead the human being back to God through Christ, if we unite these two powers within ourselves. This is what was meant to be expressed by moving the Adam and Eve festival closely together with the festival of Jesus' birthday. The perception of this connection, which gives life on earth its real meaning, has been preserved in a most intimate way for centuries. One example of this is the emergence of the deeply intimate paradise and nativity plays, such as the ones that have been performed here on the stage. They stem from the later medieval times, from the very beginning of our modern age, and were brought to regions further east by certain German tribes who had originally lived in more western regions. These tribes had settled in present-day Hungary. We can find such tribes north of the Danube, in the Pressburg area. We find them south in the Carpathians, in the so-called Zipser area. And we see them settled in Transylvania. In these regions we find primarily Alemannic Saxon tribes, and in the Banat we find Swabian tribes. All these German tribes brought with them from their original homeland their treasured folklore that had assimilated what humanity, out of deepest heartfelt feelings, had experienced over the centuries in relation to the most important event on earth. But this wisdom of humanity increasingly evolved to a stage where even the Christ event became entwined in the materialistic conception of the world. In the 19th century, we see a theology emerging, which itself was becoming materialistic. This is the time when Bible criticism began. People were losing the possibility of being able to sense, as ought to be the case in relation to supersensible descriptions, that what is presented as an imagination of the supersensible appears differently, depending on whether it is seen from one viewpoint or another. People no longer have a concept of the fact that the sages of earlier centuries must also have seen the so-called contradictions in the Gospels, but that these were not denounced by them in a critical way. People become engrossed in these contradictions in the Gospels in a dogmatic manner. The contradictions are resolved, and everything supersensible is removed from the Gospels. The Christ of the Gospels is lost. People then attempt to make something like an ordinary profane story out of the Gospel story. It reaches a point where one can no longer distinguish what the theological historians say from what a secular historian such as Ranke says about the mystery of Golgotha. If we look at the Jesus figure as described by the famous historian Ranke and see how he depicts Jesus as the simple human being, albeit the most excellent who has ever walked the earth, if we read all the lovingly described features of Ranke's secular story about Jesus, then in an inner sense, this description can hardly be distinguished from what the materialistically inclined theologians of the 19th century have to say about the Jesus figure. Theology has become materialistic. It is especially in the, in quotes, enlightened theology that Christ disappears from humanity's understanding. To those who undertake to describe the nature of Christianity, the, quote, simple man of Nazareth, close quote, gradually becomes the one and only thing to be considered. And it is particularly Adolf Harnack's description of the nature of Christianity that has become famous. There are two passages in this book by Adolf Harnack, titled The Essence of Christianity, that can really be quite shattering for anyone who has a sense of the real essence of Christianity. The one thing is that this theologian, who aspires to be a Christian theologian, said that Christ does not really belong in the Gospels, that the Son does not belong in the Gospels, that the Father alone belongs in the Gospels. Consequently, Christ Jesus, who walked on the soil of Palestine at the beginning of our era, this Christ Jesus simply becomes the human being proclaiming the teachings of the Father. Quote, The Father alone belongs in the Gospels, close quote, so says Adolf Harnack, and in doing so, considers himself to be a Christian theologian. It must be said that the essence of Christianity has completely disappeared from this essence of Christianity. I am referring to what Adolf Harnack describes. And that in reality, such an opinion should no longer be considered Christian. Another passage in this book, titled The Essence of Christianity, that can have a devastating effect, came to my attention once when I attended a lecture given in a society that called itself the Giordano Bruno Society. As a consequence of what was said there by a certain speaker, I had to come to the conclusion that the most important thing about the essence of Christianity has disappeared from modern theology. I had to point to a comment by Harnack in this book, The Essence of Christianity, where he says, quote, "Whatever may have happened in the Garden of Gethsemane, the idea of resurrection, the Easter belief, arose from this event, and we want to adhere to this belief," close quote. This means that to present-day Christian theologians, the resurrection itself has become a matter of indifference. They do not want to concern themselves with the actual resurrection as a factual reality. Quote, "Whatever may have happened in the Garden of Gethsemane," close quote, people began to believe that the resurrection occurred there, and that it is not the resurrection itself that they want to abide by, but rather, in quotes, this belief. At that time I pointed out that the essence of Christianity was articulated by Paul, who, as a direct result of what he experienced before Damascus, said, quote, "And if Christ had not risen, we would all be lost," close quote. It is not the human being, Jesus, that is the essence in Christianity, but rather the supersensible being who entered the human being, Jesus, through the baptism by John in the Jordan, who rose from the grave in Gethsemane, and who became visible to those who had the ability to perceive this visibleness. Paul had most recently developed such abilities and was able to see it, and Paul called upon the risen Christ. And so in those days I had to point out that the observations of one of the most famous so-called Christian theologians of that time failed to notice what is the essence of Christianity, namely its supersensible nature. The chairman of this society then replied to me in a very peculiar manner. He said that these remarks could not possibly be in Harnack's book, because Harnack was a Protestant, an evangelical theologian, and if Harnack had said something like that, it would be tantamount to statements that could only come from the Catholic side, such as the one about the holy tunic in Trier. He said that to a Catholic, it is not important whether one can prove that this holy tunic in Trier really comes from Jerusalem, but what matters, rather, is that faith is tied to this holy robe. The chairman of this society was so prejudiced that he could not even admit that these remarks are actually in Harnack's book. I even offered to write the applicable page number on a postcard for the next day, since I did not have the book at hand. Incidentally, this is also characteristic of the, in quotes, thoroughness with which such undeniably important books are read these days. People read a book, believe that it has a significant impact on life, but then do not even notice one of the most important observations in it, and instead actually believe that these remarks are not even in the book. But they are in the book. In any case, all this shows us how the supersensible Christ has been cast out of human evolution by a theology that is becoming more and more materialistic, and how people are clinging only to the external physical appearance of the human being, Jesus. However, the festival customs and ceremonies of the simple, unpretentious souls who took hold of the Christmas place were beautiful. They arose from holy feelings. Even if people were no longer able to understand the full meaning of the mystery of Golgotha, it still existed in their feelings, also when they adhered to the physical appearance of the child Jesus in an outer sense. And presented in this way, the celebration of Christ's birth is beautiful and intimate. The intellectual reasoning that eradicates Christ in the human being, Jesus, is not beautiful, and seen from the highest perspective, also of the Christian worldview, is not true either. It is as if the wisdom-filled guidance of humanity had first taken stock of what needed to happen, so that the materialistic view, and with it the development of humanity toward freedom, could have its start and then advance from there. Just as materialism had to occur at all for the sake of humanity's freedom, so it was necessary that the festival of the appearance of Christ, which can only be understood through supersensible perception, be moved back from January 6 to the festival of Jesus' birthday on December 25th. And in between these two dates lie the 12 holy nights. One could say that humanity underwent a reverse journey through the entire zodiac by experiencing, at least in a symbolic sense, a 12-fold quality in moving this festival. Today, by combining everything that through the human being Jesus is associated with Christ, we can indeed unfold a sense of intimacy and a profundity of inner feeling at the festival of Christmas. And in yesterday's contemplation about Christmas, I attempted to express in words what is appropriate for our present time in this regard. However, now that materialism has found its greatest triumphs in theology, now that Christ Jesus has become merely the simple man Jesus to an enlightened theology, we must find our way back again to developing a sense of the supersensible, extra-earthly Christ being. But if one presents this viewpoint, then it is precisely the materialistically inclined theology of the present time that feels offended. Just as the sun sends its physical light down from extra-earthly cosmic expanses, so Christ descended to humanity as the Spirit Son and united with Jesus of Nazareth. Just as we can see a manifestation of the soul's spiritual in a person's outer physiognomy, in the facial features and in the gestures, so we can see an outer physiognomy in what is taking place in the cosmos, that is to say, in those gestures that are sketched into the cosmos by the passage of the stars, in what is displayed externally as the inner soul warmth of the universe through the rays of the sun. In all this, we can see the outer physiognomy of the soul spiritual that permeates the entire cosmos. And in what is concentrated spiritually, in the descent of Christ to the earth, we can see the inner aspect of what is streaming down to the earth externally in the concentrated rays of the sun. And then you will understand the following statement in the right way. The sun being of Christ descended to the earth. We must find our way again to this supersensible understanding of Christ. And even though we want to preserve the inner reverence for the festival of Jesus' birth, for what Christmas has become exclusively, we must nevertheless learn again to develop a sense of the other birth, which is an extra-earthly birth that came to pass through the baptism by John in the Jordan. We want to understand what arises before our souls as a significant historical symbol through the baptism by John in the Jordan, just as we understand what happened in the stable of Bethlehem or Nazareth. We want to learn to understand in the right way the words that are communicated in the Gospel of Luke, quote, "This is my son, today I have begotten him," close quote. We want to learn to understand the mystery of Christmas in such a way that it again becomes the source of our understanding of Christ's appearance on the earth. We want to augment our remembrance of the physical birth with learning to understand the spirit birth. Such an awareness can only emerge gradually, as the result of a largely spiritual understanding of the mysteries of the universe. We must gradually aspire again to a spiritual conception of the mystery of Golgotha. For this, however, we need insight into the origin of the kind of impulses that were present in the earthly development of humanity, such as the one that arose in the 4th century AD when one of the innermost needs of a developing humanity, the festival of Christ's appearance, was moved from January 6 to December 25, the festival of Jesus' birth. We must learn to observe how the wisdom-filled guidance of the history of humanity works. We must learn to immerse ourselves in this historical development with our whole being. Then we will recognize the wisdom-filled guidance in the history of humanity without bringing superstition or self-made fantasies into it. We must learn to deepen our understanding of history, not just with abstract notions or from the perspective of cause and effect, but we must learn to devote ourselves to this historical development with our whole being. Only then will we understand what makes our time truly a period of transition, a time in which a spiritual worldview must be wrested from the materialistic view, a time in which we should strive to ascend to the supersensible in a natural way. And one expression of such an ascent to the supersensible will be a new understanding of the appearance of Christ on earth, of the mystery of Golgotha. And so, to those who are really able today to immerse themselves in the spirit of the time, the Christmas festival is something twofold. It is what has arisen in our most recent history since the 4th century A.D., what has produced such wonderful loveliness, especially in the simple, unpretentious folklore, what still elicits an inner delight from us today when we see these folk plays again in a renewed production, as we are attempting to do here out of our anthroposophical knowledge. It also is everything that people have poured into life in the way of heartfelt warmth throughout the centuries, during which the concept of Christianity assumed ever more materialistic forms, until it reached a point in the 19th century where this concept's own absurdity made it necessary to turn around and come back to the spiritual again. And this is what has led us as human beings of the present time to the second aspect concerning Christmas. It is the awareness that along with the feelings we bring toward the traditional Christmas festival, which first emerged in the 4th Christian century, and the warmth of heart with which we want to accompany this festival, a new Christmas must be born out of a time-appropriate understanding, a second Christmas to join the old Christmas. Christ must be reborn through human beings today. In keeping with remembrance, Christmas should be the festival of Jesus' birth, in keeping with the Spirit. It should become the festival of the birth of a new conception of Christ. New, not as compared with the earliest centuries, but new as compared with the centuries since the 4th century A.D. And in this way, the Christmas festival itself should not be only a festival of the remembrance of a birth, but it should become, inasmuch as it will be experienced year after year in the near future, a festival of an immediately present birth, a festival of a currently occurring event. This birth of the new Christ concept must be fulfilled, and the Christmas festival should attain the kind of inner intensity that makes it possible, each year again, and especially at that time of the year, for people to particularly reflect on the fact that a new conception of Christ must be born. From a festival of remembrance, the Christmas festival must become a festival of the present time, a festival of what human beings experience as a birth in the immediate present time. Then it will truly find its way into our more current historical process of becoming. Then it will gradually gain strength within this historical development of humanity, also into the future, where it will be so very much needed. Then it will become a world Christmas. The end of Lecture 9.